On behalf of Torah Moshe Rana, welcome everybody to actually only our second class in 2022. And it's a pleasure to welcome David Weinberg, who I go back many, many, many years with. David moved from Toronto, where we grew up not far from each other, right before the Gulf War. I remember, right? August 2nd, am I correct? That's when you made Aliyah?
August 6, 1990.
August 6. Okay, I was off by 4 days. Not bad. And David is being a defense and diplomatic expert. If the person can mute himself, hold on, I'll have to mute you. Hold on, I'm sorry, apologize there for that. Okay. All right, that's better. And he has worked for the Prime Minister's office. He worked for Deputy Prime Minister Sharansky. He has a degree in international relations from University of Toronto and then a master's at Bar-Ilan University. He studied at Yeshivat HaKotel, Yeshivat HaRetzion, and has been living. He writes in the Jerusalem Post every week, and he's a wine connoisseur. Having studied in London, the London-based International Wine and Spirit Education Trust, the world's leading institute for qualifying, I don't even know how to pronounce it, sommeliers, is that how you pronounce it, David?
Sommelier.
I drink so little that not even on Purim do I have a repeat of alcohol. So I want to welcome you, and a pleasure. David's been living in Nafayolon for many years, 6 kids, and making a huge contribution to Israel. And this is a sideline that he does in addition to all his political analysis. Bakasha, David.
Thank you, Rabbi Jay. The main purpose of this talk is to try to convince Rabbi Kelman to do tshuva and learn to start drinking quality kosher wines.
And I thought you were going to say to do tshuva and make aliyah. That's what I was expecting you to say.
That comes immediately afterwards. And let's see if we can make some progress in this regard. Thank you for inviting me. I'd like to do 3 things in this talk. Number one, explain to you what excites me so much about Israeli wine, why I feel that the Israeli wine industry is not just a technological marvel, along with Israel's many other high-tech advances, but why it fills me with deep and great spiritual sustenance. Second of all, I'd like to look a little bit deeper with you at Chazal's approach, primarily Kabbalistic and Hasidic thought, as to the importance of fruit grown in the land of Israel in general and grapes for winemaking in particular. And that will take us into a deep dive into the Torah relating to Tu Bishvat and Purim, both of which are approaching. And third and finally, I'd like to look at the modern Israeli wine industry, describe for you some of its achievements, some of the trends underway in modern Israeli winemaking, and as I said, try to convince you to buy more quality kosher Israeli wines and drink more, and that includes you, Rabbi Jay. So with that introduction, allow me to begin. To me, grape growing and winemaking is much more than just another Israeli startup nation agricultural innovation. The Israeli wine revolution to me is a sign, a siman muvhak, an undeniable, stark indicator of support from Shamayim, from the heavens. It's a sign of divine favor. Consider the following. We know that in the heyday of King Solomon's reign in Bayit Rishon, the 10th century BCE, the Torah tells us in Sefer Melachim Aleph, Vayeshev Yehuda v'Yisrael Avetach, Ish tachat einato, tachat gafno v'tachat einato, midan v'ad Bersheva, kol yemei shlomo, that Judah and Israel dwelt safely, every man under his vine and under his fig tree, from Dan to Beersheba. Wine played a central role, as we know, in all community festivities. Nisu Chayayin in the Beis HaMikdash. And we have archaeological evidence that Israeli archaeologists have discovered over the last 100 years of literally thousands of ancient wine presses and wine storage facilities, mainly wine storage amphorae, which are clay jugs, from the first and second Batei Mikdash, the first and second Commonwealth periods. Even after the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash in 70 CE, Jewish agriculture and viticulture declined, but the Romans were major wine grape growers and wine producers. But then in the 7th century, the Muslim conquerors came, and they literally ripped every grapevine out of the ground, and this put an end to the production of wine in Israel, in the land of Israel, for many hundreds of years. Just 150 years ago, as I'm sure you all know, Mark Twain visited the land of Israel and noted how utterly barren he found it. And despite all this, modern Israel has become an internationally acclaimed wine center. Just 150 or so years since Zev Tepperberg and then the Baron Rothschild harvested their first grapes and began to make wine. And the question is how and why? How has that transformation come about? And some will start to answer this question by pointing to Israel's unique climate, its soil conditions, what's known as terroir, the way in which Israel now has well-trained grape growers who've trained in the best institutions in California and Australia and Italy. These are all worthy topics, and maybe we'll get to some of them later. But I prefer to look to Yaakov Avinu, who just two parshas ago prophesied on his deathbed to his sons that in the land of Israel, wine would be so abundant to the point where Yehuda, Shevet Yehuda, Judah, will wash his garments in wine and his clothes in the blood of grapes, and also that his eyes will be shot red with wine. The pasuk from Bereshit Mem Tet is Osri La Gefen Yirov V'Lasoreka Bni Atono Kibes Bayan Levushav V'Dam Anavim Suto Hachili Einayim Yain Leven Shinayim Mechalav. And centuries later, after Chorban Bayit, Chorban Bayit Rishon, Yechezkel, Ezekiel prophesied that he declared that in the days of redemption, God would command the mountains of Israel, he would command the mountains of the Holy Land to shoot forth your branches and yield your fruits to my people Israel, for they will soon come. V'atem harei Yisrael, anfachem titenu, ufirichem tisau, l'ami Yisrael ki kervu lavo. And I feel that these biblical prophecies seem to be coming true in our days. As I said, over the past century, the land of Israel has awakened, giving forth its glorious fruit to its indigenous people, the Jewish people, as it returns to and renews its ancient homeland. It's almost as if, indeed, the heavens have commanded the long dormant and deep rooted vineyards of Israel to grow. It's as if the vines have awoken from hibernation, stretched their roots and smiled at us, and turning little dirty, dusty, nearly dead Israel into a garden of Eden and even a world agricultural superpower. And this includes almost every fruit and vegetable, from almond and apple to asparagus and avocado, and of course, the finest fruit of all, grapes. The Gemara in Sanhedrin tells us, Amar Rabbi Abba, Rabbi Abba says, Ein lecha ketz megule mizeh. There is no greater revealed sign of redemption than the agricultural reblooming of the land of Israel. And he quotes the pasuk that we just, that I just mentioned from Yechezkel, Vatem Hare Israel, and Fechem Titenu, Ufrechem Tisal, Lam Israel. We can go a step further. There is a deep mystical thought, and we're going to get deeper into this in the coming minutes, that the Shekhinah, the divine presence, enters the Jewish soul through the agricultural produce of the land of Israel. This is the Bach, Rav Yoel Sirkis, on Tur Or HaChaim. Tur Or HaChaim, Simon Reishchet. And he says very clearly that he's discussing there, you know, Birkot Hanehenin, brachot you make over different foodstuffs. And he makes it clear that the reason why we say in the bracha achrona, we say v'nochal mi'piria v'nisba mituva, that our soul is nisba mituva, our soul is filled and elevated by eating holy fruits, that the Shekhinah, he says, the literally the divine presence enters the Jewish soul through produce of Eretz Yisrael. And let's not forget that the Ramban teaches, this is a famous Ramban, I'm sure many people on this call are aware of it, that the fact that the land of Israel lay fallow, the fact that the land of Israel lay desolate for so many years is actually a bracha in disguise, because the land of Israel did not give itself to other foreign conquerors. This is the Ramban in Parshat Bechukotai, and he said, the pasuk says, "V'natati et arechem chareva." This is the tochacha, that as a result of our sins, God will desolate, destroy the land of Israel. "V'hashimoti ani et haaretz v'shamemu aleha oyvechem hayoshrim ba." And the Ramban says that this is actually divine favor, that "ki me'az yatsanu mimena lo kiblua." Ever since the Jewish people were expelled from the land of Israel, exiled from the land of Israel, every other nation has tried to settle the land of Israel and has not succeeded, because the land of Israel won't accept them. And only when the Jewish people return to the land of Israel, as Yechezkel prophesied, does the land of Israel reawaken and give its fruits to the Jewish people. This brings me to my final point in this section of the talk, which, of course, there is concrete halachic expression to all the uniqueness of the fruits of the land of Israel that I've talked about, because there is a special status given especially to wine made in Israel. Before drinking such wine, there's an additional bracha that can be made in certain circumstances, which is hatov v'ametiv. In addition to making borei pri hagafen, hatov v'ametiv, blessed is the good one who does good, which you can make on upgraded wine beyond, if you started with grape juice and moved to more sophisticated wine, you make a bracha hatov v'ametiv. And this is a truly special bracha that's normally reserved for special circumstances, such as the birth of a child. And only after drinking Israeli wine does one give thanks by intoning another special bracha, which is al ha'aretz ve'al peroteha. That's on the fruits of the land of Israel. And if it's wine, al ha'gefen ve'al ha'aretz ve'al michya ve'al peroteha. In other words, halacha codifies the unique status of Perot Eretz Yisrael, and specifically of wine grown in the land of Israel. Neither Hatov V'Ameitiv as a bracha rishona, nor Al Hagefen as a bracha achrona apply to kosher wines produced in, say, California, Italy, Spain, or France. So now I want to turn to the second part of my talk and ask the question together with you, why grapes? Why wine? is given this special status more unique than other fruits. We know how over the last 100 years, Zionist pioneers love to sing and dance about all the fruits of Israel. We all learned the song Ashkedia Porachat, that the almond trees are blooming in the spring. And we all grew up valuing Jaffa oranges, oranges grown in Israel. And these almost became real symbols of the Zionist agricultural revolution. And yet when it comes to wine, things are different. And here, in order to understand this, we have to take a step back and go deep into Jewish theology, philosophy, and even Kabbalistic understandings of Jewish thought. And this ties us directly to Tu Bishvat, coming up in just under 2 weeks, Rosh Hashanah Leilanot, the new year for trees, and then at Tippur. So there's a special law that applies to all fruit grown on trees in the land of Israel, and that's Mitzvat Orla, for the first 3 years, fruit of freshly planted trees cannot be used. The Pasuk says, V'chitavo el haaretz, when you come to the land of Israel, the first thing you ought to be doing, says the Torah, Unta'atem ko etz macha, plant fruit trees. But ve'orlatem et orlato et piryo shalosh shanim yelachem arelim lo yachel. Very unusual pasuk with the word arel, uncircumcised, three times. Ve'orlatem once, et orlato et piryo shalosh shanim yelachem arelim lo yachel. And on the fourth year, b'shanah shvit, yeh ko piryo kodesh hilulim Hashem. And on the fourth year, the fruit becomes holy and almost like fresh and holy. The concept of Orla is very a very important concept. We know of several types of circumcision and uncircumcised elements in Jewish thought. There is Orla in trees, as it were, the uncircumcised fruit of the first 3 years of trees. There's Orlat Basar, which is, of course, Brit Mila, the uncircumcised male sexual organ. We know from the story that we're reading in the Torah right now about Moshe and Yetziat Mitzrayim. Moshe says he's Aral Sfatayim, that his lips are uncircumcised, and therefore he won't be a good spokesman for the Jewish people. He tries to wiggle out of the task in his long discussion with God at the Sneh. And then there's the concept of Orlat Alev, some sort of uncircumcised flesh that covers the heart. We talk about it a lot at Rosh Hashanah, that the heart needs to be circumcised. In all cases, in all four of these cases, Orla means pagum. It means that something is covering either the fruit or the male body or the lips or the heart. And somehow, in the case of fruit, it becomes something holy in the fourth year. In order to understand this concept, we have to go back to primary sources and the primary story of all, which is Gan Eden, the story of Eden and the first man, Adam Arishon. As I said, the first story, the first commandment for the Jews to come to Israel is to plant fruit trees. What does God do? At the very beginning of the story of Gan Eden, he plants fruit trees. The Midrash emphasizes the parallel between the two by telling us, and I'm just looking for the text here, by telling us, Mitchilat Briato, this is Vayikra Rabba, on the mitzvah of Orla of trees. Mitchilat Briato Sholam lo nitasek kadosh baruch hu ela b'matat tchila. When God created the world, the first thing he did was plant fruit trees. Hadao dichtiv, as it says, Vayita Hashem Elkim Gan Beiden. God planted, he planted a garden in Eden. And therefore, he tells us, Afatem Shenichnasim La'aretz, you too, the Jewish people, when you make aliyah and conquer the land of Israel, lo titasku ela b'matatchila. First thing you should also do is plant orchards. And it quotes the pasuk of that I quoted earlier about planting and then keeping the mitzvah of Orla. What happened after God planted this Garden of Eden with the unique trees there, the Eitz HaChaim, the tree of life, and Eitz HaDaat Tov V'ra, the tree of knowledge, good and bad? Adam HaRishon, Adam and Eve sinned, and they ate from the tree they were told not to eat from. They were told they could eat from all the trees. Mikol Eitz Hagan Achol Tochel, but only one tree they shouldn't eat from, which is the tree of knowledge, good and bad, Eitz HaDaat Tov V'ra, and they sinned. And as a result, they're punished. And one of the punishments, the relevant punishment for this conversation, is that the land of Israel was cursed in a way that things would not grow easily and naturally as they naturally did in the Garden of Eden, but man would have to slave at agriculture. The natural growths would be kots v'dardar, thistles and thorns, and the land would be arid and dry, and man has to pray for rain and then till the ground and then harvest the wheat and winnow the wheat and take the kernels and grind them and mix them with water and bake bread. It becomes a long, difficult process. How do we in our lives do tikkun achet? How do we fix or repair that sin of Adam of Eve in Gan Eden? And the answer is by facing the same nisayon, facing the same test that they faced and not failing. What was their test? Their test was patience. Wait. God says you can eat from all the trees in the gun. And Chazal say, you'll eventually be able to eat from Eitz HaDaat Tov V'ra, the tree of knowledge, good and evil as well. But patience, not yet. But they found the tree so appetizing. And the snake convinced them that it's there's powers that are going to come if they eat that tree. And they sinned. They failed to wait. They failed to have patience. That's the concept of Orla. Waiting 3 years for the fruit of a tree to ripen and only eating from it in the fourth year is a tikkun of Chet Gan Eden. It's a repair of the sin of giving in to your base desires, beauty, food, taste, and even sexual attraction, and running towards that in an uncontrolled fashion. That's why we do Orla, circumcision, on the male sexual organ, a way of showing that we can restrain our sexual passions. That's why we do Orla with fruits of the land of Israel, to show us that we're not repeating the sin of Adam and Chava in Gan Eden. That's why we try to circumcise our lips, which means don't speak Lashon Hara. That's why we try to circumcise our heart, which is a way, again, of not giving in to passions, whether they be anger, hatred, or excessive love. That's the concept of Orla, of restraining ourselves. And the beauty is that in the fourth year, those restraints, that evil that's built into reality ever since Chet Gan Eden becomes something holy. You take the fruits and you eat them physically in Jerusalem and it becomes a spiritual experience. And that's a way of returning, as it were, to Gan Eden, of being able to eat the fruits that God has given us in B'Kedushav Tahara in Yerushalayim. So Rosh Hashanah, the holiday of Rosh Hashanah, which is Rosh Hashanah to God's creation of the world, is a return in many ways to a point, to a pre-Adam and Eve sin moment. And a world where there's no kikul. And Rosh Hashanah Ilanot Tu Bishvat, which is the marker date for counting years of Orla, is a return to a world where the fruits are no longer tainted by a mixture of good and bad, something that came into the world through the sin of Adam and Eve. And this brings us to Purim. Purim is all about good and bad. In fact, the two words most common in the Gilat Esther are not Ahasuerus or Esther or Haman. The two words most common in the Megillah are Tov Vara, good and bad. And if you haven't noticed this before, you'll be amazed when you listen to Megillat Esther this year, because it's so obvious that's incredible that until I learned this, I never noticed it myself either. And not only that, in the first half of the Megillah, only the word Tov appears 1,000 times. Ketov lev ha-melech b'yayin, at a time when the king's heart was gladdened happily with wine. And he brings out Vashti larot le'afim kitovat marehi. And Esther says to the queen, imel melech tov yetzei dvar ha-malchut milfanav. And they're going to give the kingdom instead of Vashti to Leruta hatova mimena. Vaitava davar be'enei ha-melech. And he looks for betulot tovot mar'eh. And they brought all the betulot tovot together. Vanara yifat tor betulot mar'eh. And on and on and on. And ima melech tov, ima melech tov. And Haman leaves the king's palace when he thinks he's got in his hand the decree to kill all the Jews. The word tov appears dozens of times in the first five prakim of the Megillah, and the word ra does not appear even once. And that all changes at a critical moment in the Megillah when Esther unmasks Haman, and she says to the king, I need you to do something for me. Imatzati chen b'necha melech, v'ima melech tov, there's the word tov, tinaten li nafshi v'sheilati v'ami v'vakshati, and she points to who's the guy trying to kill my people, ish tsar v'oyev haman hara hazeh, the evil, the bad Haman. And from that point on in the Megillah, the word ra appears over and over again about Haman Asher, the eights that he made, Ra'at Haman HaGagi, Yikatev Asfarim Shom Machshevet HaHaman, Ki Eich HaChav Ra'iti Bara'a Asherim Tzatami, and many, 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 many other occasions. And in the last Pasuk of the Megillah, we come back to the Tov, Ki Mordechai Ayudi Doresh Tov Le'amo, Mordechai does good for his people, V'dover Shalom L'chol Zaro. What does this all mean? So first of all, what I tried to show you is that the use of the words good and bad are starkly and manifestly spread throughout the Megillah in a very organized fashion. And what this means is that all the so-called Tov that we read about in the first half of the Megillah, which is Ahasuerus's drunken, evil world, that's all false goodness. It's a world of shallowness, of emptiness. Everything Tov mentioned there is really not Tov, is not good at all. And Tov Vara live in a horrible and dangerous mixture. The Tikkun, again, is to differentiate between Tov and Ra, which is what Esther starts to do by identifying the Ra, by pointing to the evil, by pointing to the bad and saying this is Ish tsar v'oyev haman hara hazeh. And she begins the process of separating good from evil. Of course, it's not coincidental that every single significant decision in the Megillah, kill the Jews, save the Jews, and so on, is made in a mishteh yayin. Ketov lev ha-melech b'yayin. Not only that, the Midrash points out that Haman was a manifestation of the snake from Gan Eden. And it points out that there are 70 psukim in Megillat Esther until Haman is hung. And there are 70 psukim at the beginning of Bereshit, the beginning of Genesis, until the Nachash, the snake, is mentioned. So that at the 70 marker is where evil enters the world, and we have to, our job in life in general, our job as correcting the sin of Adam and Eve, and our job in rooting out evil in the world is in differentiating between good and evil. Chazal give halachic standing to this by telling us in the Shulchan Aruch that on Purim, specifically Purim night, after we read the Megillah, Sarich Sheomar, we're supposed to say, it's in the text of Tefillah that we say after reading the Megillah Purim night, Arur Haman, Haman is cursed, Baruch Mordechai, Mordechai is blessed. We have to distinguish between them. Arura Zeresh, Zeresh, Haman's wife is evil, Brucha Esther, Esther is blessed. Arurim Kol of De Elilim, all the idol worshippers are evil, Bruchim Kol Yisrael, all the Jewish people are blessed. But Tzarich Sheomar Gam, V'gam Charvona Zachor Latov, and Gam Charvona Zachor Latov, again, there's the word Tov. The idea being that the Avodah Pnimit, the Avodah Shebalev, the internal spiritual movement that we seek to do on Purim is to separate out the good from bad. You're all going to ask me, so why do we drink ourselves to abandon on Purim? To the point where Ad Lo Yada, where we're not supposed to be able to distinguish between Baruch Mordechai and Arur Haman, why do we drink ourselves to a point of abandon? And the answer here, and this is a very deep concept, which I'll try to explain briefly. We can elaborate on it more later. But the concept is that after having distinguished between good and bad, after using our intelligence, our da'at, that which God gave us, to distinguish between good and evil, we want to go one step further. We want to go one step higher. We want to move beyond a world where evil and good are mixed together, the world we live in ever since the sin of Gan Eden, and reach a world where there is no evil, where there's only Ki Mala Ha'aretz De'at Hashem, that the whole world is filled only with the knowledge of God. And you do that by obliviating, by wiping out Haman, which is why we wipe out Haman's name and make noise during the Megillah. We do that by drinking ourselves to a point where we go beyond the level of consciousness that distinguishes between good and evil, and we reach a level of consciousness where we're one with God, where there is no evil in the world, where our souls aspire to be one with God. This is a concept that's developed both by the Sfat Emet, the Admor of Gur, and later by Rav Kook. There are many famous passages. And the Gemara tells us that, in fact, the tree that Adam HaRishon and Chava ate from in the Garden of Eden, there are four opinions in the Gemara as to what type of tree it was. None of them say it was an apple tree. That's Christian thought. But one of the four opinions, Rav Meir says, it was a grapevine. And on it were growing grapes. And Eve picked the grapes and squeezed them to produce wine. And it was wine that she gave Adam Arisha. And the Gemara goes on to say, this is Gemara Yerushalmi, Yesh Shote Yain V'Tovlo, Yesh Shote Yain V'Ralo. You can drink wine and it can make you bad. We can drink wine and you can lose yourself and lose control of your senses, lose control of your emotions, lose control of your intellect. Aval Yesh Shoshotim Yain V'Tovlo. You can drink wine and it can elevate you to a higher spiritual state, to a world in which there is no admixture of good and evil, where the world is all good, where the fruits have no mixture of evil in them that need to be circumcised through the years of Orla, but they are pure. And it's through those fruits that grow in the land of Israel that the Shechina can enter the Jewish soul, the Bach tells us earlier. And we seek to return to the level of Adam and Eve at their most pristine, pure forms of their soul, which was in Gan Eden before the primordial sin. That, in very, very short form, is the Kabbalistic theology behind the meaning of the Gan Eden story, the meaning of planting fruits in the land of Israel, circumcising the fruits of the land of Israel by waiting to fix the sin of the Jewish, the earliest people in the world, Adam v'Chava, and then to eat it in its purest form, Neta Ravai in the 4th years, in holiness in Jerusalem, or to eat in the land of Israel on Purim and at other Jewish occasions. And with that, I'll move briefly to the third chapter of this discussion, which is about the modern wine revolution in Israel. Over the past decade and a half, Israeli wineries have garnered top flight international awards for their products. Just to mention two or three particularly notable awards, the Carmel 2006 Shiraz won the international trophy at the Decanter Wine Awards in England, one of the top wine competitions worldwide. The Golan Heights Winery won the Grand Vintali Vinitaly Award for the best global producer in 2011. These are unprecedented distinctions for Israeli wines in some of the toughest wine competition. Robert Parker's Wine Advocate magazine, which is highly regarded for its rankings, gave the Yatir Forest and the Domaine du Castel Grand Vin scores of 93 points or more. Six wines from the Golan Heights Winery, from Gvaot, from Shiloh, from Psagot and Tulip won gold medals just 2 years ago at the Decanter World Wine Awards in London. Two of these went to Shiloh, which also earned 7 silvers and 4 bronze. And one of the gold medalists, Psagot, which is in the Binyamin region, north of Jerusalem, received the highest decanter score of any Israeli wine with 96 of 100 points for its wine called Psagot Peak, which is a Rhone Valley blend of Setit, of Syrah, Petit Syrah, and Mourvedre. And some of you may remember that Psagot received even more important recognition when then U.S. Secretary Mike Pompeo visited Psagot to celebrate U.S. recognition of settlements as a legitimate expression of Jewish rights in Israel. The owner of Psagot Winery, Yaakov Berg, is a passionate fighter against European boycotts of Israeli so-called settlement produce. And he's also a big global marketer of biblically inspired food packages and health products from Yehudah v'Shomron. And therefore, as I said at the start of my talk, quality grape growing and winemaking is more than simply another Israeli agricultural startup nation innovation. It is a siman mufak, a sign of divine favor, an undeniable stark indication of support from the heavens. Now, there are some very interesting trends underway in Israeli winemaking, two of which I'll tell you about now. One is that for most of the last 100 years, ever since Montefiore brought his rootstock over from, Rothschild brought his rootstock over from his chateaus in France, like Chateau Lafitte, which is until today still a Rothschild-owned premium chateau. He brought over the the varietals, the grape types that he was familiar with that grow in Burgundy and in Bordeaux in France. Grapes that you'll be familiar with their names, like Cabernet and Merlot and Cabernet Franc and so on. And while Israel does grow quality Cabernet and Merlots today, there is a very strong trend underway in Israeli winemaking to move to planting and growing grape varietals, types of grapes that are more attuned to the Israeli climate, which is much hotter than Burgundy and Bordeaux. Grapes that are grown mainly in Spain, Portugal, Italy, and in the southern areas of France, such as the Rhone Valley. And that those are grapes like Syrah, Grenache, Mourvèdre, Cinsa, and others. You'll find many wines in Israel today that are basically what's known as GSMs, Grenache, Syrah, Mourvèdre. That's a classic Rhone Valley blend. The Rhone Valley, again, is southern France and even farther south, all the way to the coastal areas of southern France. And the GSM varietals seem to grow better here. There are famous winemakers in Israel, such as Pierre Midovnik, who've planted only these Mediterranean varietals and produce wines made only from these Mediterranean varietals. And it's a growing trend, and it's a debate among Israeli winemakers as to in which direction Israel can best make its mark on the international wine market. A second trend is that climate change and global warming has pushed the alcohol levels in Israeli wines higher and higher. And this is, in my view, a tragedy and a terrible mistake. Wines that are 14.5 or 15% alcohol are simply too alcoholic. The alcohol overpowers the fruit aromas and flavors. It's a problem now in Europe as global warming is affecting both yields and the quality of grapes grown in places such as Bordeaux and Burgundy. The New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, I don't remember which it was, had a story just a few days ago about how some of the quality grape growers in France are moving to locations that are a little bit farther north and a little bit cooler because it's gotten too hot in some of the more southern areas to get the best quality grape. And that is something that Israeli winemakers are dealing with. You have to pick the grapes at the very right moment. You don't want them to be unripe, and you don't want them to be overripe. 99% of winemaking is the quality of the grape. And the additional 1% is, of course, the various processes, procedures, and techniques used by winemakers in cultivating their product, the way in which they ferment it, the way in which they store it, the way in which they blend and mix it. And that's where the winemaker's unique style have come into play. There also is a third trend underway in Israel, and I'll only mention this briefly because it's still a very young and not significant trend, which is to seek to grow grape varieties that apparently grew here hundreds or thousands of years ago. Israeli archaeologists have discovered grape seeds, live grape seeds, in archaeological digs and in amphorae across the country. There's a winemaker named Dr. Shivi Drori, who's the owner and winemaker of Gvaot Winery in the Shomron, who also has a lab at Ariel University where he has been seeking to regrow some of these ancient seeds. And there are several wineries in Israel that have now planted these seeds that go back either to the early Islamic times or all the way back to the time of the first and second Jewish Commonwealth. These are varietals that you probably never have heard of, like Mandali and Bituni. And there are some Israeli wineries such as Gvalt and Rekenati and others that have produced, that have planted, grown these grapes and made limited run productions of wine made from these grapes. And perhaps it'll become more of a phenomena in future. Because again, the Israeli wine industry is looking for a unique expression. Yes, there's quality Cabernet and Merlot grown in the upper Galil and Golan, as well as in the Judean hills, and even in the Negev mountains, the Yatir area, as well as in the coastal plain, but there are excellent Cabernets and Merlots, perhaps even better Cabernets and Merlots grown in Europe and elsewhere. And if Israel wants to stand out, it needs to find its own unique expression. The final trend that I'll mention is that increasingly the quality wine producers in Israel are seeking to own, manage, and control their own vineyards. Meaning, as opposed to buying grapes from growers all over the country, they're seeking to take control of their own vineyards, control the growth of the grapes in these vineyards themselves, and use only their own product. There are lots of good reasons for doing so. Definitely makes the wine more expensive, but there are lots of good reasons for doing so. And this also gives the smaller boutique wineries a little bit more cachet to be considered what's known as a winery that has its production facility in its own estate. And that's what's called an estate winery. It controls its own vineyards. It picks its own grapes. It produces the wine all in the same location. Gives the wine the moniker of being an estate winery and a little bit more of a vertical integration, as Rabbi Kelman is commenting, and a little bit more of cachet. I'll close before taking your questions with one of my favorite Gemaras. It's a Gemara in Eruvin, Samech Dalet Amud Aleph. Very short sentence. Amar Rabbi Nachman, Ana Kokama Delo Shatina Riviata Dechamra Lo Tziladate. Rabbi Nachman says, any day that I don't drink at least a revi'it of wine, my head is not clear. To clear my mind, I need to drink at least a revi'it of wine every day. I recommend that to everyone. It's good for your heart. And as I've discussed earlier, I truly believe it's good for your soul as well. So with that, I'll stop here. Thank you for your patience. And Rabbi Kelman, if you want to field questions or you want me to look at the chat and answer comments.
You want to look at the chat? I mean, I can do it, but you might as well take a quick look. You see the beginning? Ruth's question, Orla's waiting, why three, not six?
That's an excellent question. I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know. I have to think about that or look up an answer in the Sfarim. The second comment is about Mishle. Listen, there are different trends in Jewish thought. You can argue that intoxication with wine leads to abandon in a bad way. The Gemara says that. Or mild intoxication with wine leads to productive thoughts and a consciousness that is more refined. You may be right that Mishle warns against this, but in Chazal, there's a lot of that. So I don't know that Mishle has the final word on this. Someone asked here about primordial sin being a Christian concept. Yes, it is, but it's also a Jewish concept. We don't like to admit that because we want to stay far away from Christian theological concepts as much as possible. And Christian thought takes it a step further, that because of primordial sin, man is condemned in a way that he can never truly find salvation. He can never truly refine his soul. The only way he can do it is by belief in Oto Ha'ish and connecting to the Christ Godhead. We don't believe that. Adam HaRishon sinned in a significant way that impacts Jewish thought across the board. And it impacts Jewish thought, as I just showed you, in Purim. It's a key concept in Jewish thought in Hanukkah, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur. There's a series of books, which I highly recommend. It's a series called V'Nahar Yotzeh Me'Eden, that the rivers depart from Eden, as the Torah tells us, written by a brilliant, brilliant young Torah scholar, Harav Uriel Eitam. He's the deputy Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshivat Yerucham in the Negev. He's a very deep scholar. So far, he's produced three books, which is all about how all of our holidays, all the holidays in the Jewish calendar are connected to the story of Gan Eden. And in every Jewish holiday, we are seeking in some way to repair that original sin of Adam and Eve in Gan Eden. So original sin is a very deep Jewish concept as well. We don't take it to where the Christians go because we don't believe that man is damned to eternal damnation unless he believes in Oto Ha'ish. So if it sounds a little Christian to you, the study Chazal. It's a very deep concept in Chazal. And those of you who can handle the Hebrew, buy the three books. He's working on a fourth book now, which is on Shabbat and Gan Eden. And we all know that Shabbat is Me'im Gan Eden, and that keeping Shabbat is a return to Gan Eden, a step back from the world of 6 days of work. There's a whole Torah about returning to Gan Eden and repairing the sin of Gan Eden. There's a couple other questions here about the modern wine industry, and I'll try to look at them briefly. First of all, water is very expensive in Israel. And that's one of the reasons why Jaffa oranges and other Israeli citrus fruit is not such a big deal anymore, because Israeli fruit growers have been ripping out their orchards, which are very water hungry. Of course, tremendous amount of water to grow oranges or other citrus fruits, and instead planting grapevines, which require very little water to grow. Actually, that's only partially true. The dormant grapevines in the winter need water, rain, and cold temperatures. And then in the spring and summer, when the grapevines begin to flower, and then the fruit begins to come out, a point which is called the verizon, they need little water. And Israeli grape growers water the grapes with very little water. It's just much more economical for them to grow grapes than it is to grow citrus fruits. And that leads me to another question here, which is about the cost. Israeli wines are expensive. Kosher wines are expensive. The main reason for that is not the kashrut, but simply the small economies of scale. You know, the entire Israeli wine industry is maybe, producing 40 million bottles of wine a year. That's a drop in the bucket compared to winemakers in not just Spain, Italy, and France, but even places like Australia, Chile, and the western coast of the U.S., California. And when you don't have the economies of scale, your cost per product is higher. And by and large, Israeli wines are just beginning to get known abroad. And there's still a lot of misnomers out there about what kosher wines mean. And is kosher wine really a quality product? And is a kosher wine that's been made mevushal, flash pasteurized, truly a quality product, and so on. there is a big problem with growing the Israeli and the world kosher market, certainly in terms of economies of scale. Be careful. Not all wines grown in Israel are kosher. In fact, of the 400 or so wineries in Israel, only about 150 of them are in fact kosher with proper supervision. That includes all the major wineries in the country, all the big five, which are Barkan, Tepperberg, Carmel, the Golan Heights, and one more. They and another several dozen wineries produce the vast majority of wines grown in Israel. The other smaller boutique wineries, maybe another 200 of them, produce infinitesimal amounts of wine, maybe 1,000, 2,000, or 3,000 bottles a year. These are not just, that's not even considered boutique wineries. Those are considered, you know, micro wineries or garagists, garage wineries. And generally, you won't find them exported abroad. They simply don't have enough product. The big wineries are all exporting. As much as 60% of their product today is exported abroad. And of course, export raises the costs. In places like the Australian, the British, or the Canadian official liquor stores, such as the LCBO in Ontario, you're not getting the best wines. You may get wines from some of the top of the line wineries I mentioned earlier, but they're usually selling their lower series because otherwise they become too expensive. To get the higher level series of wines produced, you really need to go to the private importers. I know of several in Toronto, and or do your own importing, which is complicated but possible, to get the really the top flight Israeli wines. Let me take a look at some of the other questions. Okay, this is an interesting question that comes up all the time, especially from non-Jews. The question was, is there a wine that's specifically designed and produced to serve in religious rituals? Is there a specific process used in winemaking to produce wines for religious rituals? And the answer is absolutely no. That's the short answer. The answer is no. Kosher wine is wine made as wines are made all over the world. The kashrut comes from four or five factors, which we can talk about in a moment. But there is no wine that's specifically designed for religious rituals, whether that be, you know, Kiddush or a Brit Milah, or even wine that was poured on the Mizbeach, on the altar, in the temple, in temple times. There is no such specifically designated wines. Kashrut, which is a topic perhaps for an entire additional lecture, is a function of multiple layers of halacha, beginning with the fruit itself, especially if it's grown in the land of Israel, where mitzvot hatliot ba'aretz apply. It starts with orla and then teravai, and then it goes on to trumot u'masrot, the various tithes that have to be taken. And then, of course, there's the inyan of the matter of the sabbatical year of Shemitah. There's an entire world of halacha that applies to the fruit itself. Then, on top of that, you have layered thousands of years of rabbinical edicts with regards to drinking wine with non-Jews, or drinking wine that was produced by non-Jews, or drinking wine that was poured by non-Jews, and in some extreme manifestations, which some kashrut organizations in Israel insist on, even wine that was seen by non-Jews during the process of its production. And this goes back to both rabbinic attempts to separate Jews from non-Jews, to prevent young men from getting drunk with the locals and running off with their daughters, mishum chatnut. It goes to the notion that some wines were used by idolaters in their religious ceremonies, in idol worship, and anything used in idol worship is forbidden in Jewish law in the most extreme way, and that includes wine. And then you get into definitions of who is a believing Jew and who is a non-believing Jew. Does an Israeli secular Jew who believes in God and is circumcised and plans on circumcising his son and participates in a Pesach Seder and serves in the Israeli army and believes in Jewish peoplehood and God's providence over the Jewish people throughout the centuries, including our return to the land of Israel, but doesn't keep Shabbat as Orthodox law mandates, is that person considered a blasphemer or equivalent to an idolater for the purposes of making wine turn from kosher wine into non-kosher wine? And that's a big dispute among halachic authorities today. I have very strong opinions on this topic, but like I said, that's for another conversation. The only other last issue there is with kashrut of wine is you have to be sure that the shmarim, the how do you say shmarim in English? Losing my English, the yeast.
Preservatives.
The yeasts that are used to ferment the grapes in order to produce alcohol and the grape juice, that the yeasts are in fact from kosher sources. Anybody else want to throw a question out at me? Or otherwise I'll just look back at the chat.
I'm just looking at what you might have missed going through, but okay, yeah, take a quick look while you...
What do you mean by non-kosher yeast? What's that?
I don't know enough about this to give you a full answer, but there is such a thing as non-kosher yeasts that are either are grown from animal extracts or grown in the ground in a way that doesn't keep the mitzvot atluyot baretz.
Yeast is a microorganism. It doesn't grow in the ground.
No, but they actually produce yeasts from different things that are grown in the ground today, as well as from animal extracts. It's a complicated issue. There's also the issue of preservatives that are added to most wines today. But these are easy issues to deal with. There are plenty of yeasts and preservatives that are allowed to be added to wines in general and to kosher wines in particular, and they're easy to get a hold of. So the other issues I mentioned are much more central in the question of defining what wine is kosher and isn't. There's a question here that's a little bit more of a practical question about the serving and the pairing of wines. So there's an entire world of enology, of wine Torah, about what wines pair best with what types of food. The general two rule of thumbs are that white wines pair best with dairy, fish, and poultry. And red wines pair better with hard cheeses or meat meals. And the second rule of thumb is that you seek to balance foods that are particularly oily with wines that have a high acidity in order to get a well-balanced taste in your mouth. And part of drinking wine is enjoying the experience in your mouth as it pairs with food. But the truth is that none of these rules are hard and fast, and you can go any which way you want. There are people who only drink white wines, including with heavy fleishig meals and cholent. And I enjoy quality red wines, even with dairy, poultry, and fish. And these rules, most of which came from France, are no longer followed religiously in the world of good gastronomy and even the best restaurants around the world, or the best restaurants in Israel. So these sort of rules of etiquette of pairing food with wine exist, but they're definitely not obligatory. I'll answer perhaps one more question here, which is a little more personal. Somebody asked me how did I wend my way into the world of kosher wine, and particularly kosher Israeli wine. Some 20 something years ago, I moved to my neighborhood in central Israel, Nof Elon, adjacent to Shalavim, adjacent to Modi'in, and I discovered a new neighbor. His name is Shiki Rauchberger, who happens to be one of this country's most famous and most celebrated and most expert winemakers. He was trained at the Davis Institute at the University of California in Davis, one of the top places in the world for training winemakers, as well as at the Faculty of Agriculture of the Hebrew University in Rehovot. He worked for many years at Carmel Winery and was greatly responsible for their quality wine revolution. And for the last decade and a half, he's been the chief winemaker at Tepperberg. He's one of the grand old men of Israeli winemaking, and I started following him around, going to wine festivals with him, going to wine tastings with him, meeting and learning from him, and it grew on me. And the Torah that I discussed with you earlier, the Torah relating to wine, grew on me, and maybe it has something to do with my name, Weinberg. Who knows? Maybe generations back, some of my ancestors in Poland were grape growers or winemakers, although I don't know that to be the case. And like I said, it is both fun and delicious and spiritually satisfying for me. I'm now running food and wine tours in Israel. We had one just last month, 3 days in the Galil and Golan, visited a dozen wineries with quality food, good food at all mealtimes at the wineries, along with guided wine tastings by the winemakers at their wineries. A second such tour is departing 2 weeks from now on Tu B'Shvat, again for several days in the Galil and Golan. And those of you who are not afraid to travel and are vaccinated enough and can get here in time for March, we have a third such tour planned for the week before Purim in early March. And we're constantly mixing up the wineries and changing the balance between them. And it's a lot of fun.
Okay, thank you. And somebody wants to know what wine you have behind you.
Okay. First of all, thanks for reminding me. I've got two bottles just behind me that a little bit of leftovers from a party that we had here on Motzei Shabbat. One is a bottle called the Matar Kumulus. Matar is the kosher line from the Pelter Winery on Kibbutz Ein Zivan up in the Golan. It's an outstanding winery. Like many small Israeli boutique wineries, as they grow, they realize they ought to go kosher and expand their market. And they often do it this way. They open a second line. They give it another name. In this case, Pelter opened a second line, called it Matar. All the Matar wines are kosher. They make a very fine expression of Bordeaux blends up in the Golan, Cabernet Merlot, Cabernet Franc. This Kumulus is a blend of just that, Cabernet Merlot and Cabernet Franc. An outstanding warm climate a version of growing grapes of a Bordeaux blend style wine in Israel. The Golan, of course, the unique abilities about the Golan are twofold. Number one, the soil is volcanic, which turns out is great for growing grapes. And the temperature differentials up there are enormous. And that's exactly what you want. Very cold at night because it's high up, and very hot during the day. And that temperature differential makes for great grape growing. Second bottle here is the exact opposite trend. The trend I talked about earlier, Domaine de Tofa, is a boutique winery in Mitzpen of Tofa in the lower Galil, very close to Kibbutz Levi and Tzomet Golani, for those of you who know the area. Pierre Midovnik, who's a French-trained Haredi Jew, began planting some 15 years ago, only the Rhone Valley varietals, the Mediterranean varietals I spoke earlier, in the lower Galilee, in the area around Har Tavor and Netofa. This is a blend of Mourvedre and Syrah. It's called the Netofa Tel Kasser Mourcir. Completely different wine from the Golan wine that I showed you just a moment ago. Two great examples of very different styles, both in growing grapes and in making wine here in Israel.
Amen. Okay, I think with that, we can let David go and enjoy and whatever. It's a late evening wine and cheese tasting, whatever. But thank you very much, Yasher Koach. And okay, I think very nice. And right, the Tu Bishvat is coming up and Purim and everything. And please God, we can get to Israel soon. They've just taken Canada off the red list. And maybe one of these days they'll take the United States off, and maybe people will be safe and nice to travel. Please God. And then we can try to, you know, get to Israel and see and visit. But thank you very much, Rabbi David.
I understand that Canada is not
We're locked down again, Ontario. You know, we're going back to Zoom school.
Air Canada's direct flights from Toronto to Israel probably will not come back before March.
That we already know.
However, Air Canada is flying through Frankfurt, as is Lufthansa, and LAL still has its direct flights, but at a reduced schedule.
Right. So Air Canada announced a while ago there are no flights till March. And whatever. It's I don't know how many people want to go, but whatever. Hopefully soon. Maybe before Pesach. So the four courses, maybe every course will be a different style of wine. That's over Pesach. Okay. Thank you very much. I put up where the final touches. 95% is up of our winter schedule coming up. Really are officially starting on Monday. Got about 12 classes coming up. So look forward to learning with you, and you can take a look, and I'll send out an email a little bit later when we finalize 100% of the details, hopefully in the next day or so. And get the, but you can take a sneak peek, and we look forward. You can register for once, you know, then you get all the announcements, if you know, for those who want to come to a number of classes. Next class is tomorrow night. Dr. Sokolow continue his series on Tanakh and how Tanakh evolved. And then Thursday night, the Parsha Shir this week, Yaakov Jaffe, Rabbi Yaakov Jaffe of Maimonides, and Friday morning, my Shir 9 a.m. on the Siddur. That's for this week. And then we'll pick up next week. Rabbi Liebtag will complete a series on Sunday, and then we'll start sort of with our new series beginning on Monday with Rabbi Dr. Lindsay Guhartz talking about Islam for Jews, what you should know about Islam, a 10-part series. Beginning Monday at 11. I'm sure, David, you could speak to that a little bit, but for another time. Okay. All right. Be well. Regards and enjoy. Thank you very much, everybody. Look forward to seeing you soon.